Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome to another edition of Your Health Today with Good Samaritan Hospital. Today, we're going to talk about Good Samaritan Spine Center with Margaret Radcliffe, who's a nurse, and she is the Spine Center Care Coordinator. Margaret, welcome. Good to have you here with us today.
Thank you.
So this is a big thing for Good Sam in terms of what the Spine Center does. Tell us about that.
Well, we've taken our spine experts and integrated everybody together to give a collaboration of treatment for our patients.
So what does that mean? How's that different than what you might get somewhere else? What does that mean?
Well, instead of just calling a physician's office, getting an appointment, coming into a physician office, and then he look at the patient and say, well, maybe I can't help you with your problem. I'm going to send you somewhere else. And then the patient kind of out the door they go, and now they got to go to another office and kind of start the process all over again.
Mm-hmm.
We're kind of changing up how that process is going to work.
So how do you think that benefits patients in a better way than, let's say, anybody else could do?
The patient will be able to call into the call center. Their information will be sent to me as a care coordinator, and I'll speak to the patient, get some of the vital medical history, information about their pain, any treatments they've already had, and forward that to the surgeon before they've ever even seen the surgeon, so he can kind of start to look at their profile, figure out, and make sure that he's the right expert for them to see.
So tell me about the kinds of things that people would come there for. I mean, who would the Spine Center treat?
Well, it's interesting that one of the number one reasons that patients go to see their primary care physician is back pain.
Mm-hmm.
So back pain, neck pain, especially as we begin to age, go into the middle, you know, ages, we start to experience a lot of problems with our necks and our backs.
But Margaret, everything that is a back pain isn't necessarily related to spine, right?
Well, it could be, or it might not be, and that's the problem. Often a patient will call a spine surgeon, have an appointment, wait several weeks, only to find out that there's some other problem going on, or they indeed do need to see a surgeon. Often patients are afraid to call a spine surgeon because they don't want to have surgery.
It's a scary thing when you think about your spine.
Sure.
It's frightening for people.
Less than 20% of those experiencing back and neck pain actually end up in surgery. There's all other kinds of interventions and things that can help.
Like what? What kind of things would take place before surgery would take place?
Well, there's specialists with pain management interventions. There's injections, physical therapy. There's even complementary therapies such as acupuncture, things like that. So there's all kinds of avenues out there. And so it's our goal to bring all of these people together to collaborate on ideas of how to get to the patient to the right specialist in the shortest period of time.
Because this orthopedic spine world is a huge part of what Good Samaritan Hospital does.
Absolutely. We have a long-standing history, over 30 years of orthopedics and neurosurgery.
What's your role there? What do you do there?
As a spine care coordinator, I'll be the contact person for the patient, so kind of guiding them through the process because it can be overwhelming. They have different people they need to go see. They may have questions, kind of help expedite that care and be that communication between the physicians and the patient and the other providers to make sure that everything goes smoothly for the patient.
And you've been in this field for a long time. I mean, in medicine as a nurse.
Yes. I started in orthopedics and have remained there over 15 years.
15 years. That gives kind of a sense of quiet and reassurance, because you've been doing this for so long, because this is an integrated medical group, doctors, nurses, all kinds of other healthcare providers.
Very much so, yes.
Margaret Radcliffe, thank you so much for being with us today. It's a pleasure to have you in the studio.
Thank you, Mark.
For a free Spine Center brochure and for referrals, call 443-444-4142 or visit goodsam-md.org. Good Samaritan Hospital, proud member of MedStar Health. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome back. And before we start, I'm going to remind you that support for WEAA is provided by the law offices of Sandra Martin Douglas, offering yesterday's work ethic in today's legal world through quality representation and sound legal advice in criminal, family, and personal injury legal matters. To schedule a consultation, call 410-685-6181 or online at smdlawoffices.com. That's smdlawoffices.com. We are once again going to have another one of our stories on race. OSI Baltimore has had this series on race and why race matters. This is, I think, the fifth show we've done with them since they started that series. And this one is being done with the Stoop Storytelling Series, which is an incredible series. I was actually on the very first Stoop Storytelling Series. I wanted to be on this one, too, but they said they don't do things twice. That's fine. But I still love what they do. And this particular one is about race. And there are 8 storytellers, including Congressman Elijah Cummings, who will be there Monday night. This will be at Monday night at Center Stage, 7 p.m., receptions at 8 p.m. That's the 22nd. And you can call 410-234-0091 for more information. The event is sold out. But there are tickets available for bloggers and reporters. That's interesting. So bloggers and reporters, you can call that line and go. But this should be an incredible event. And so we're going to have 3 of those storytellers here with us this hour. We're joined in studio by Paolo Gregory Harris, who is a community activist and a musician and many other things. And I have to disclaimer, I've known him for too many years. Good to have you in the studio, man.
It's great to be here.
And David Schwartz is with us. David Schwartz is an instructional designer at Johns Hopkins University. And in a minute, we'll be joined by Michelle, the great comedian, who is on her way here, but she, like the rest of the world, are stuck in snow. And you can join us here at 410-319-8888. And what we want to hear from you, after we hear the stories from our guests, are your stories about race. Paolo is going to talk a bit about what it was like to experience as a black man being on Election Day in 2008 in Hamden, which historically in this town, until recently, was not just an all-white neighborhood, but a neighborhood that if you were black or Jewish and walked through the neighborhood, you better be ready to rock and roll in the streets because you weren't allowed in the neighborhood. Neighborhoods change, but he's going to talk about experiences there. David Schwartz is going to tell us a story about being one of the few white kids at Pimlico Junior High School. That means he's a little older because they don't call the places junior high schools anymore. They're now middle schools. But it was junior high school back then in 1970 and how scared and alone he felt being there. Michelle will join us to talk about moving from Park Heights to a northwest suburb and making friends with 2 Jewish girls and how she taught them double Dutch. And they taught her about gefilte fish. So she'll be telling that story when she arrives. And you can tell us your stories at 410-319-8888. I want to hear your stories about race, about the first time you confronted race in your life or crossed a racial divide in your life. And any of those stories would be great to have your own personal stories from wherever you're listening to us from. 410-319-8888. But let's start our stories here in the studio. So who wants to go first? Paolo, don't you go first?
I'll touch in. I'm actually going to reserve most of the story that we're going to be telling on Monday because we don't want to spoil the experience.
Don't forget, we won't spoil the experience because you're going to have, there are tens of thousands of people listening now who are not going to be able to get through the door.
Right, but we're going to touch on sort of the preamble to that story. I remember arriving in, I came to Baltimore to attend MICA. In the late 70s. And, you know, as you come to any new place, you are told what you need to know about a certain place. And as a black man coming to this city, I was told 2 things. Don't go to Hamden and don't go south of Cross Street into Federal Hill or what's South Baltimore.
It wasn't Federal Hill then. It was South Baltimore.
Yeah. And, you know, and stories accompanied those warnings. Story that I was told from a couple of friends of mine who actually moved to Hamden, a black woman and her partner then, that there was actually a cross burning on her yard in Hamden. And, you know, when you hear that kind of stuff, then, you know, it's definitely clear warning to stay away from certain areas. Another couple that I know who was actually a gay couple in that moved to South Baltimore had machine gun fire actually into the wall of their house. So as a 18-year-old kid coming to live in the city for the first time, I grew up in the suburbs of Philadelphia, Abington, Pennsylvania, and so coming to a place like this for the first time, coming to a city and then hearing those experiences, also after having my own kinds of experiences where I came up, I was actually, when I was 12, my parents had moved to a white community just out of Philadelphia, sort of moving up, as they say. In that case, it was to the north side, not the east side, and we moved to this community and were the only black family in that community. And, you know, it was an amazing, amazing experience. I was five when we moved and, you know, things happened like the community actually got together to try and block us from moving into the community. The neighbors wouldn't allow me and my brother into the pool and everybody else in the community could go swim in the neighbor's pool. When I was 12, there was a situation that occurred when I went to a church fair that was down the street, a carnival, and I talked to a white girl whose name was Donna, and I just had a conversation with Donna. About 15 minutes later, I heard footsteps behind me following with what was then called greasers were following me around the carnival. And this white friend of mine, Andy, and I just said, okay, well, let's just get out of the carnival. Probably not the best solution. Leaving the carnival he was held and I was jumped by those six guys and beaten to the point of being put in the hospital. So, you know, it was not a distant memory to have those kinds of experiences and then come. And so you take those warnings very, very seriously. Should I pause there or should we?
You don't have to pause. Unless okay. You want to pause. You want to pause. It was good. We were waiting for the rest. It sounds good.
You know, it's been, as Mark said, that Hamden has actually really shifted. And I play music. I play music in Hamden. You know, it's still, though, there's the avenue. And then there's what's next to the avenue. Even still today, I think that it's not a very welcoming environment when you leave that central pathway in Hamden. On a particular day last year, it was election day, and I'm a motorcycle rider also, and happened to be riding through Hamden with my Obama T-shirt on, and actually, I think I spent that evening with you, and you probably didn't know this, but actually had an accident in Hamden, went down on my motorcycle, and was supported by folk that looked like the folk I was told not to confront. You know, it's a very auspicious moment, especially given the president that was coming into office to have that kind of experience on that day and to be supported and a bridge to be built between myself and folks that I shouldn't be talking to if you follow all the rules that society gives you. And it was very caring, kind of loving support that I got from these two guys that were not, you know, were not my people, and were also people that I've been told would hurt me rather than help me. So it was a pretty amazing moment. That evening, this is a part of the story that you won't hear. That evening, the sitting with Mark and his children and his grandchildren and folks from all generations and lots of different colors in the living room of his daughter's house and watching the moment when watching the moment when amazing thing happened, and being in a room that was filled with folks of every age, color, race. I mean, it was really a beautiful evening to sit there experiencing extreme pain, but having that pain dulled by the amazing moment and the quantity of whiskey that I was drinking was very helpful.
Yes, Val and I have that. She put those things on Facebook, the pictures she took.
Yeah, exactly.
So, and welcome, Michelle. Michelle is in the studio. You made it through, baby, didn't
yes,
you?
I did. Yes.
Good to have you in the
studio. I'm so glad to be here, Mark.
It's good to have you here. You're going to do cleanup. I mean, in terms of the story.
See what happens. You got to watch it, Mark. I got a big couple Yiddish words under my belt. You want to start some trouble, we can get it started.
But we're going to... I came out the wrong way. But we're going to turn it over to David Schwartz and have David Schwartz tell his story he'll be doing at Stoop Stories about his experiences being one of the few white kids at Pimlico Junior High in 1970.
Sure. Well,
and welcome. Good to have you in the studio with us.
Thank you, Mark. I came from and I grew up in Mount Washington, which, of course, is predominantly Jewish. And so I spent kindergarten through sixth grade at Mount Washington Elementary, School 221 on Selgrave. And it is, you know, very highly Jewish. Some other non-Jewish kids, but very, very few black kids. And
what year was this again?
Wow, got to do backwards math. 1970s when I got to Pimlico.
Right.
Yeah. And also Mount Washington is a pretty small school, as opposed to Pimlico, which at the time I think it was supposed to only hold 2,500 students. It held 2,700 that year. They were there, the year that I was there, and probably 90 to 95% black. I don't know the exact percentages, but that's my understanding. So, you know, it was clearly going to be a different place than what I was used to. And I wasn't naive. I mean, I don't feel like I was sheltered. I used to go downtown a lot on the bus. The number 10 bus used to run through Mount Washington. I'd go down there. Go down to Lexington Market, where it seemed, you know, blacks and whites got along pretty well. I didn't see any incidents, and nothing happened to me. So I feel like I wasn't naive about what what I was walking into. And we talked about this earlier. The fact that the classes in the city schools at that time were divided up, particularly, I guess, students coming from places like Mount Washington, where we had there was the regular set of classes, and then there was the enriched and the accelerated. The enriched
right.
being for, in my opinion, the students who didn't apply themselves as well, who were coming from these good schools. That
right.
was where I was first, and then the accelerated. But the result is that we didn't get to really rub elbows with a lot of the other kids. They were still, you know, that my class was predominantly white. So, and I think that really sort of kept us separate, and I'm sure there was resentment about that because we were separate, and there were just a lot of incidents, a lot of shoving, particularly in the stairwells. That's where girls would be shoving and kicking at the backs of your feet, my feet.
I mean, the black kids were pushing and shoving you.
Yes.
Right.
Only black girls. I don't know why it was, but in the stairwells, it was
we
only
like
black girls.
We like to shove white men. Especially ones that let us get away with it.
and I did. But I, and it was, I, you know, to be clear, it was very few girls. But it also, I should say, I was a young 12-year-old, little, short.
You're a short, skinny Jewish kid in an all-black school.
Exactly. That's
yeah.
very
right.
concise. Yeah, yeah.
And but you talked a bit about the fear you had.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was a scary place to that extent, especially out in the public areas of the school, in the stairwells, in the halls, where people were asking for money, threatening, you know, if you didn't give them money, that you know they're going to meet you after school. Yeah, and
no, go ahead.
No, that's true. It was. We were, you know, especially at those times in the public areas, out in the hallways and in cafeteria.
So Michelle is with us, who was on our show last week. Was
yes,
last week?
I know. We got to stop meeting
Lamar.
Like this.
I know. Well, your husband was here last time, though.
Yeah, he was here. So
and your baby.
Yeah, she was. She took the show, from what
I
understand.
She was great. She was amazing.
But David, just to kind of veggie back, because I don't eat pork, but just to veggie back on what you just said, you know, you said something about in the public areas, you know, there that's where all the action happened.
Right.
But when you were in your classroom, you felt it was sort of like a safe little haven for you, right?
It was. I mean, there was nothing. Yeah. But it's unfortunate because if we had been, you know, if everything had been mixed together, we would have had opportunities to get to know the students that we didn't get to know.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. But, you know, my story is just kind of like the opposite of David's story. It makes it so funny because I was raised in the beautiful Park Heights area the African-American Park Heights area between, you know, my early days were on Garrison Avenue between Reisterstown and Park Heights. So that
right.
those few blocks that spread between, there were nothing but working class and middle class African-American families with moms and dads and kids who Bethlehem Steel lifers. Then you had your Provident Bank workers. My aunt worked at Provident forever. You had your Sinai Hospital workers. That was my grandmother who'd been working there forever. And so we had this, you know, this beautiful African-American community. I was one of, I'll say, 11 kids. And you'll have to come to Stoop Stories to find out how that actually happened. That's a little plug for you to come see me at Stoop Stories.
Chapter sold out.
Yeah, but you can come and walk up. There may be some walk-ups. That's
maybe,
what we were told.
Some walk-ups.
So we don't want to discourage people from walking up. You might get turned away, but then you can stalk me online. But anyway, no, but being one of 11 kids, and the reason that happened is because we ended up being the grandkids of my grandparents. My mom had us at a very young age, and back in the 70s, you couldn't be a teen mother. You had to pretend like these were kids that you found in the alley, and you just brought them home. And then we called our grandparents mom and dad, and we called our mom by her first name, real weird for the first couple of years. But that was our family. And all the neighbors could tell you, you know, go in the house if you're being too loud. You had a corner store. Every corner, there was a corner store. You learned economics very early because you had a dime. You could get, you know, two cookies for a penny, and you could get squirrel nuts. You could get now or later. I mean, you learn economics. You get them now or later. You learn economics at, you know, 3 and 4 years old because you're running back and forth to the corner store. And then there was the coming on of the lights. If the lights came on, we all had to come up on the step. You know, there were all these rituals in our neighborhood that made us feel supremely safe and loved and cared for. And everybody looked like me. Everybody looked like me. And so for me, this was the way that the world was meant to be until my mom met my dad, who decided he wanted to marry the little girl from Park Heights and take her out to the suburbs. And when she told us about it, and you can hear more about it in Stoop Story, we were like, where are we moving? And I just remember leaving that whole area and driving, and it felt like forever, but I think it was probably 5 to 7 miles to the northwest suburbs because we drove past what used to be Gwin Oak Theme Park. On Gwin Oak.
Avenue. Yeah.
It used to be a theme park, my mom says. Okay. I remember when they tore down the roller coaster thing. And I'm like, we're riding past the theme park to get to this new house? And the street lights started disappearing. And all I saw was like woods, wooded areas. And there were, you know, and there were no corner stores. And I was getting real nervous. And I was about 7, 8 years old. So I'd had, you know, a good 7 years in Baltimore City. And I was loving it. Didn't want to go. So I get out there. I was telling Paul and David about the other night. You know, when I got out to the northwest suburbs in the late to mid 70s, it was me and one other African-American family on the entire block in the entire community. It was made up solely of that whole nuclear family. There were moms and dads and little kids with dogs named Lassie and Butch. And, you know, they, you know, it was like I had gotten popped into some portal. Like, this was a hologram. Like, I got bumped into the Beavers. You know, I'm like, I'm more like the Huxtables on a low budget. And then I get bumped into the Cleavers. And it was abrupt. And I just remember pulling up to the house and people just started looking out their doors. And they weren't like, welcome to the neighborhood with a pie. You know, how on the Beavers, the Cleavers, you'd get a pie or a nice bundt cake covered in some nasty cloth and be dry and you fruitcake choke on the nuts. We didn't get any of that. We just got a bunch of those like, where did these people come from? And how long are they going to be here? I think they might have thought we was coming to clean the house.
Yeah, I was about to say.
They said, well, we got a whole family to clean the house. We have to feed. How much do they cost, you know? And I'm making light of it now, but it was a little scary.
Sure.
You know?
How old were you?
I was like in second, third grade. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd gone to Arlington Elementary on Rogers Avenue, you know? That was my elementary school, and I went to preschool on Liberty Heights. So, yeah, I was used to that. We get out here, Mark, it was dark. It was real, real dark. It got dark real fast. There were no street lights. There was no corn. I couldn't hear no earth, wind, and fire playing. It was a whole lot of stuff. Because every day in Northwest Baltimore, you heard some earth, wind, and fire, some Ozzy brother, who's that lady? Well, no, who's that lady? It wasn't none of that. And I'm like, oh, my gosh. But my mother assured us, you're going to have your own bedroom. You're going to love it. You'll have a yard. You know, there were shutters, manicured lawns. I remember there were two little rude. And this is not, I'm not trying to be, you know, racist at the time. I couldn't find another word for it. There were two little rude freckle-faced white boys that lived next door to us that were like, you know, we were getting on it. And I'm like, oh, this isn't looking good. Somebody about to get punched in the face. And we just got here 20 minutes ago. So these were the kinds of things that it was a setup, Mark. It was a setup. And I was telling everybody the first day of school, you know, we got there and I couldn't sleep. Because I was waiting for the lights to come on outside, and there were no lights. And I didn't say this last week, but I remember distinctly there were wooded areas across from our house. So it was undeveloped land. And someone had told us later on down the road that was called the Lost World. And if you got in there, you would never come out. It, you know, all the white guys who had mullets and jean jackets had dirt bikes, and they would ride their dirt bikes in the Lost World, and you better not go in there or you'll never get out. So it was just weird. I met the twins. I got to tell you about the twins. Two of my favorite people in the world, Jennifer and Julie.
Little twins?
No, not those cats. Me and that dude got in a fight like the second week. As my uncle would say, this is not a word. We became unbenefited. It's not a word. Don't look it up. You'll never find a definition. But I can translate. That means me and you are going to have issues, problems, concerns that could lead to some litigious kind of thing happening. So, but Mark, we went to school and I had my Afro puffs. I don't know if y'all know what they are. Mm-hmm. That was the 70s look, baby. That's the part down the middle. Your mother made you sit between her legs. She got the comb. It was a process. She parted your hair. You got the two puffs. I felt like I was looking good. I had my Jackson 5 thing going on. I was like, oh, baby, give me one more chance. I walked into Hebbville Elementary School on Washington Avenue in the northwest suburbs. This is the Milford Mill area.
Right.
And I knew something was going to be bad because to get to the elementary school, there was a dirt road.
You had to walk down that dirt road.
No, there were no walkers. You had to be driven by your parents. You know, West Baltimore, I took the number 19 bus with my mom. So
let me just jump in here. Yeah. We're going to leave people in a little bit of suspense about what happens on this dirt road.
I'm not saying nothing else.
You can't do that. You can't come on my radio show and not say it. I'm not going
to
say anything.
You got to come to Stu's Story Center Stage.
Okay, Mark, it's up to you from here.
No. This is not fair. You're going to have to give us a little bit more.
I want to hear more about David getting beat up by black girls.
We're going to go back there, too, and find out about his experience between Obama and the greasers who helped him off his motorcycle when he fell. But we have to hear a little bit more of the story, Mitch. You can't just leave me there.
We'll just leave you there. To be continued.
When we come back from this break, we are talking this hour about the Stoop Story series that's going to take place Monday night at Center Stage. It's part of the OSI Baltimore series on race, conversations about race. We've done programs with every one of those conversations, and this is another one. Stay with us for more of that, and we want to hear your stories about race at 410-319-8888. Your first interaction with the other side. What was it? The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by Johns Hopkins Medicine. For the 19th consecutive year, the Johns Hopkins Hospital is ranked number one by U.S. News and World Report in their annual Best Hospital Survey. Find out more about the nation's top hospital at hopkinsmedicine.org. Bring us your stories. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite, Baltimore's free magazine of ideas and innovation. This month, Urbanite talks about race in Baltimore, with stories about the quest for diversity, the history of segregation, and why Baltimoreans still lead separate lives. Urbanite is available at over 800 locations. You can visit www.urbaniteBaltimore.com for a list of drop locations. And reminding you once again that support for WEAA is provided by the law offices of Sandra Martin Douglas, offering yesterday's work ethic in today's legal world through quality representation and sound legal advice in criminal, family, and personal injury legal matters. To schedule a consultation, call 410-685-6181 or go online at smdlawoffices.com. That's smdlawoffices.com. We are continuing our conversations on race with the Open Society Institute. This next conversation with the citizens, the people of Baltimore, will be at Center Stage Monday night, 7 p.m. And this is OSI Baltimore and the Stoop Storytelling Series, Across the Racial Divide, stories about race in Baltimore. Elijah Cummings will be there. Joyce Scott will be there doing a performance with, and I love her stuff. I wish she was here tonight as well, but we'll get her on soon. In the studio with us now are three of the Stoop Storytellers. They've been telling their stories. You heard first Paolo Gregory Harris, who's a community activist, and he'll be talking about his experiences as a black man in Hamden in 2008 and a bit more, if you heard him earlier in the hour. David Schwartz will be talking about being one of the few white kids at Pimlico Junior High School in 1970 and how scared and alone he felt at that time. And before we went to break, we heard Michelle's story, and she's a comedian, actress, motivational speaker. She'll be talking about moving from Park Heights to Northwest Suburbs and making friends with two Jewish girls where she taught them double Dutch, and they taught her about gefilte fish. Do you make gefilte fish?
No, I don't, but I'm learning to make matzo ball soup.
I make the best matzo ball soup.
You do make good matzo. He does make good matzo ball soup.
I'm learning. I'm virtually learning. I'm watching other people do it.
The secret is the seltzer water that makes them light.
Is it?
You know, I actually use beer in mine.
You're not supposed to use beer and matzo balls, man.
I don't know. Isn't that sacrilegious or something?
You know, black people don't do what they're told.
You probably deep fry the matzo balls first.
Me?
No, this dude right here.
So, that's a good idea.
You left us on a country road. You gonna leave us there?
The country road. It was Dukes of Hazzard gone bad. Let's just say that. It was a real bad episode. Boss Hogg ain't come get me. Ain't nobody. No, the reality is it was, I really was frightened. You know, I was frightened to be out there. It was safer in my neighborhood in Park Heights. You know, I know that sounds like an oxymoron, right? Uh-huh.
Well,
but it
deep.
Was safer. It was more love. It was a community of people who cared about you. I mean, it was just a beautiful, warm place to grow up in the 70s. And I guess when I left, that's when all, you know, the chaos came because I left Park Heights. Yeah. But, that dirt road to the elementary school was like something out of a movie. I felt like Mark Twain was going to pop up, and I felt like, you know, every novel that I'd ever read, I was waiting for, what's my girl, Tituba from, what's my book? Come on, Schwartz, you can help me here. The classics here. We're talking the classics. But anyway, I felt like something really strange was going to happen, and it did once I got to the elementary
school. Like To Kill a Mockingbird or something.
To Kill a Mockingbird.
This is the story you're not going to tell us? You're just going to leave us there?
I can't because it's already sold out, so you all, I guess I could say a little more. I'll tell you this what.
Give us a little bit.
When I walked into the classroom, when I walked into the building of Hebville Elementary School, my sister and I, 19 years apart, 2 years ahead in school she was, my mother walked us in.
19 years, 19 months, you mean?
19 months apart.
Right.
You're right. Yeah, I'm having a moment. And when my mom walked me to my classroom, there were only two other kids that looked like me. And I couldn't even see them because everybody else was white. Like, the whole class was white. And my teacher was Miss Barbara Levinson. And Miss Levinson was an amazing woman with these beautifully manicured nails and the page boy. And the she was like, I don't know, she was just like this figure. And she was like, hello, how are you? She was like, and what's your name? And I felt like all the kids were just staring at me because there was nobody else that had Afro puffs. Everybody else had golden straight hair or red curly hair or mousy brown or brunette. And I just remember this one kid saying to me, and I told Paolo about this, one kid said to me, don't you guys put mayonnaise in your hair? And I was like, mayonnaise in your hair? And what happened was this poor wretched kid had seen a commercial from a 1970s hair relaxer product with Debbie Allen, the dancer, and it shows her putting a relaxer in her own hair to straighten. She had very curly hair, and she was using it to straighten her hair. So he just assumed that all black folk put mayonnaise in their hair, and he wanted to know, did I put mayonnaise in my hair? And I'm like, don't you all like foots all up in your behind? You like to get foots in your behind. Because those are the kind of questions that would render a good foot in your behind. But he couldn't have an answer. He just turned really red. But it was at lunch that everything changed. And that's the part of the Stoop story that gets me to gefilte fish. Because at lunch, everything changed. Everything.
So this is where, lunch is where you taught white girls double Dutch?
No.
And you learned?
No. They gave me a crash course in some of the best Jewish cuisine. They gave me a crash course. I'll tell you this much. I didn't know what the white stuff was that was around their face. It was just thick and pasty, and it was on this round donut-looking thing, and it had pink things squiggling, hanging off the side of it, and they were tearing it up like it was, you know.
And what was that?
Cream cheese.
Oh, cream cheese.
It was lox and bagels.
Lox and bagels.
Right.
I was trying to think of
Look, you're, and he's, is he really Jewish?
No, I grew up on lox and bagels.
But Mark, I had never seen.
Right, but the way you describe it is beautiful.
Because it was white, thick paste. It looked like Elmer's glue with like pink squigglies and this hard donut.
And you liked it?
I just looked at it.
Did you eat it?
I was taken aback, Mark. I told David, I just stared at the girl. And she probably, what is wrong with this little Jackson 5 looking little brown girl staring at my bagel and my lox? I'd never seen it before. And she eventually said, what's wrong with you? And all I could do was point, like, what is that? And thus began our love affair. But I'll tell you, there was lots of bumps before we got there.
Folks, nobody's calling in. I don't understand that. Call 410-319-8888. We want to hear your stories about the first time you crossed a racial divide or confronted a world that was not your own and what happened with that. We've heard stories now from Michelle, these parts of it, and I can tease some more out. Maybe we can. Paolo Gregory Harris, David Schwartz, all part of the OSI Baltimore Stoop Storytelling Series that will be held Monday night. Elijah Cummings will be there as well at Center Stage. This is part of the year-long series talking about race that OSI is having. 410-319-8888. What's the first time you confronted somebody outside your comfort zone, outside where you are?
You had a different kind of upbringing around race, didn't you, Mark?
I did, a little bit.
Well, why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Oh, man. Well, this is the story I would have told if I was going
to
be on
Star Trek. Listen to this, David. Do you hear him? Sure. David.
Let's hear this, yeah.
You hear your boy over here? I would have said this.
That's what I'm right. I would have said this.
I would have. Okay, let's hear it.
Be nice, Michelle. I'm very fragile.
Okay. He's having flashbacks of being in the hallway at Pimlico Junior High as well.
I went to Garrison.
Oh, got you. Which was even...
Way before he went to Pimlico.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Tell us your
story. When it really was an integrated school. All right, real quick. Because people are calling in when I get their stories. I'll tell this very fast so we can get right to the phones. When I was 11 years old, I wanted to be a Boy Scout worse more than anything in the world. I really wanted to be a Boy Scout. My uncle from England sent me the original Lord Baden-Powell's handbook, and I read this handbook, and I just, you know, brotherhood, camping, Indian stuff. I said, I want to be a Boy Scout. So I waited till I was 11. I didn't want to be a Cub Scout. I never got into that blue uniform stuff, so I didn't want to do that. So I was 11 years old, and I went downstairs, and I said, Mom, I'm going to be 11 next week. I got to be a Boy Scout. And she was sitting at the kitchen table. My mother was British. She was sitting at the kitchen table with Mrs. Jackson, who was the woman who worked in our home, who was African-American, domestic, and her nephew, who picked her up every day and drove her home, and he was a longshoreman. And... So we were sitting around the table and we were talking about it. Mom said, well, we'll take you to Beth Tefillah and sign you up. And I said, Mom, I don't want to join an all-Jewish troop. I want to join a troop that's mixed and interracial. Well, this was 1957 in Baltimore, segregated Baltimore. There was no interracial anything happening in this town. It didn't exist. So all of a sudden, Mr. Jackson's nephew, Mr. Foster, said, I'm a scoutmaster. I have a Boy Scout troop. You can join my troop. And my mother had this glint in her eye, and she says, oh, that's a lovely idea, dear. Why don't you join Mr. Foster's troop? So that Monday, he picks me up. I have my little uniform on, all ready to roll. Troop 567 already patched on the side of my uniform, sewed on over the weekend. I was all excited to be a Boy Scout. And he picks me up. We lived on Miami Place, which was in Forest Park, which is a Jewish neighborhood in those days. And we got in the car, and we drove down... Forest Park Avenue, made a right on Garrison Boulevard, went around the junction, went on North Avenue, and then the world started to change. The world went from white to black, and I'm looking around, where are we going? We drove all the way down to Broadway, took a turn down Broadway. Broadway? I mean, Broadway and North, a little further down, to Ashland Avenue. Mm. Went to Gay Street to Ashland Avenue. Pulled up in front of the Faith Baptist Church, and we walked into the Faith Baptist Church on Ashland Avenue, into the basement, and it was an integrated troop, because I integrated.
I'm sure you did.
So here I was, a little white Jewish boy from Northwest Baltimore, on the east side of Baltimore in an all-black Boy Scout troop.
At the Baptist Church.
At the Baptist Church. And it changed my entire existence. Mm. Edwin Johnson, who later became my city councilman, was also a Panther in later days, and I became best friends. He was my camping mate along with some other guys back in that troop.
So you stuck it out, Mark?
Oh, I stayed there.
Wow.
And I learned about so much because I used to hang in East Baltimore with Edmund at his house and stay overnight. First time I ever had Kool-Aid-like stuff with cheese sandwiches.
Did he say Kool-Aid-like stuff? You know, we're not even sure if it was
Kool-Aid.
Sure Kool-Aid.
It was generic Kool-Aid.
And flavoring.
We went to camp in Broad Creek. We were the only black troop at the campsite.
Wow.
And I remember walking down, several things happened. I walked down to get my canoeing merit badge. This white Boy Scout was hanging over a fence and said, are you in that troop up there? I said, yeah. He said, well, what are you doing in a troop with all them N's?
Mm-hmm.
I was, a Boy Scout used the N-word? I was like devastated.
Because you were a diehard Boy Scout.
I didn't believe that people actually did that.
He didn't read the book.
And he didn't read the book. And then I remember one time we pulled up to a donut shop, Mr. Foster and a car full of Boy Scouts and me, and we were all sitting there together, and all the guys got out to get these donuts. And I sat in the back seat. I didn't move. I was in the ghetto. And he came over and said, no, come on in. I said, no, I'll stay here. I'll wait. He said, you don't understand, Mark. Wherever we can go, you can go.
Oh, you had a diplomatic immunity?
No, because... I'll stop there, but it was an experience that turned my life around from hearing the choir at the church for the first time to telling the Jewish story in a Baptist church when I was 12 to the congregation there. So it was an amazing experience. That was my crossing the line in 57 and never looked back.
We can attest that Mark Stein has never looked back.
That's right. And I think that's one of the amazing things about this is that life is so much more interesting when you cross the lines than it is if you stay in the box.
Absolutely. Crossing lines is the best. Let's go to the phones and see how your story is about crossing lines. 410-319-8888, a full bank of calls. We're going to write down the line. Sasha, Donna, Margaret, Tim, Chad, all of you hold on. Because you're coming to your calls. Sasha first, you're on the air in Lanham, Maryland.
Hi.
Hi,
my
Sasha.
My name is Natasha.
Natasha, I'm sorry. It says Sasha on my screen. I apologize. Go ahead.
That's okay. Thank you for accommodating my call.
Mm-hmm.
I guess there's so many things running around my head, but I grew up in Paterson, New Jersey. I don't know if you're familiar with that town.
Yes.
Is that
town.
The Lean on Me town, Natasha?
Yes, Eastside High School.
Eastside High. Mm-hmm.
And there's a river there, isn't it?
Yes, it's an industrial, it was known in the 20s to be an industrial factory type of town. So factories and things of that nature. Anyway, so I joined a church from the time I was young, an Episcopal church that was primarily white, but then slowly started to integrate as years gone by. And my first time going to sleepaway camp was at the age of 9, and that was through my church. And the camp was, predominantly white campers and staffers and things of that nature. And I remember one day I was walking down a hill with a white gentleman and some camp counselors. And he turns to me, and now my complexion is a kind of a light brown complexion.
Mm-hmm.
He turns to me and he says, hey, do you know that if you wash your hands a whole lot of times, I mean like scrub them a whole lot of times, you'll probably get to be as white as I am?
Whoa.
Mm. Wow.
Yeah. 9. I didn't know how to interpret that. I mean, in my mind, I always thought that things like that would happen if, you know, you put yourself out there, or, you know, but it was just out of nowhere. And I didn't know what to say. And then another night, another white gentleman we were on a cabin just hanging out. It was just me and several camp counselors, and they all happened to be white. And I just was friendly with one of the female counselors and was talking to her. And one of the white gentlemen on the cabin porch turns to me and says, do you know that you're the only black girl or black person out here? And it was just, you know, it took me aback because it's supposed to be a Christian type of run facility.
Mm-hmm.
And then looking back at that, it's just how at the age of 9, you know, I don't know how early or how young you were when you first experienced racism or racist comments, but how do you handle something like that?
At nine.
At 9.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you're away from home for the first time.
That's pretty frightening.
That struck a chord because we have an 8-year-old, and she wants to do a sleepaway next year when she turns 9. And you just struck a chord, Natasha. But what struck me the most was that, it was an isolated situation. And we talked about this the other night, remember, David? When all of those racist things seem to happen, they're always in these very vulnerable, isolated moments where you can't get any allegiance, you can't get any help. Because trust me, those are cowards that perpetuate that. That was a coward for an adult male to say to a 9-year-old girl, if you scrub your hands. But that's what racism, that's what it perpetuates, cowardice and ignorance.
Do you want to say something? We'll go back to the
phones. No, I'm just agreeing with Michelle. She's absolutely right.
Natasha, thank you so much for sharing with us tonight. I deeply appreciate that. Let's go to Donna in Baltimore. You're on the air.
How you doing?
Good. Well, Donna, welcome.
And I'm enjoying everybody's story because, it's good that, people can share stories. My story was I was in the 10th grade, went to all African-American school in Baltimore. I wanted to go to an athletic camp for gymnastics. Well, there was none in the Maryland area, overnight. So a girlfriend of mine, another gymnast, we went up to the Poconos to a camp. And we, not knowing that we were the only one, they've never seen African-American women, young girls. And as soon as we showed up, it was like the director of the whole gymnastic camp had to come in their house, and they wanted to make sure everything was okay. And we were just like flawless because we didn't understand that we were the first ever to integrate that camp.
Hmm.
And they treated us with, respect. Every day his wife would come by our cabin and make sure everything was okay because they wanted to make sure we were comfortable. And that was my first time actually experiencing a all-white environment where I was only African-American, and the kids and even some of the students who were in the camp, they were asking us all kinds of questions of how does it feel to be black and, you live in the city. And it was one girl, one white female, she was Jewish, and she was ostracized. And so my girlfriend and myself took her under our wing, and she told me, she said, I want to show you my fiance, and he was black. And I said, oh, my gosh. She said, that's why they ostracizing me, because they don't like the fact that I'm engaged to a African-American male who's in the military. And so we became good friends, up until the time it was time to leave. So, a lot of the prejudices are within, even among within themselves when they ostracized this young lady, who was very nice. And then, of course, dealing with the fact that we integrated this gymnastics camp up in the Poconos.
Yeah, Donna, you guys just bum-rushed the camp, didn't you? You were like, guess who's coming to camp? Forget guess who's coming to dinner. You're like, guess who's coming to camp?
Now, this camp, did you grow up in Baltimore? Where'd you grow up?
In Baltimore.
In Baltimore.
Northwest Baltimore, in the Jewish area of Northwest, Upper Park Heights.
You live up near Michelle.
Yeah, you were up there with me.
Right.
But you were above.
Well, there's always been this thing where the Jews moved in from East Baltimore all the way down through where Mondawmin is now, out through Park Heights, right to town, Liberty Heights, and black folks came right after.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, black Jewish neighborhoods become, like Pikesville is now
a
black neighborhood where it once was a Jewish neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Let me, Donna, appreciate the call. Let's try to get to some other stories. I really appreciate the call. Eric, you're on the air.
Hi, good evening, everybody.
Good evening.
Good evening, Eric.
This is a grown-up experience, but it really fits in here. In 1986, I was teaching physical education at Southampton Middle School in Bel Air, Maryland.
Mm-hmm.
And I was the only African-American teacher on staff. Only African-American teacher on staff, but I had a great relationship and rapport with all of the children. In particular, this one white boy, his name was Chris. I can tell you his last name, but I won't.
Okay.
I really love
that's fine. Yeah.
But every morning, Chris would meet me on my hall duty post, and we would talk about things. We'd talk about school. We'd talk about life. And then when he would come to my third period class, he wanted to be the line leader. He wanted to help carry equipment. He just loved being around me, and I really enjoyed being with him and sharing. But come February, Valentine's Day was coming up, and there was a young black girl who did not have a date to the school Valentine's dance. So I said to Chris, I said, Chris, why don't you take Sonia?
Mm.
And Chris said, I can't, Mr. King. I said, well, why? He said, because she's a Negro. I said, what does that mean, Chris?
Did he say 1986?
1986.
And he said Negro?
Negro.
He had bigger issues than taking that black girl to the prom.
Well, go ahead. Vision story.
And here's the real issue. He said, my father and my pastor said that Negroes are like animals. I said, well, Chris, what does that make me? And his eyes got as big as silver dollars.
Hmm.
And he began to cry, not out loud, but tears began to run down his face.
Hmm.
He backed away and ran down the hall. And from that point on, Chris never spoke to me again.
Oh wow.
Before then, he had never seen color. He saw a person who loved and cared about him just as I saw in him. And he, somewhere along the line, somebody really messed him up.
That's a sad, sad story.
That is.
But the beautiful part of the story, though, is the relationship that you all had. And regardless of whether he couldn't handle the cognitive dissonance in his soul where the people he knew, loved, and trusted said one thing and the other person he knew, loved, and trusted said the opposite or brought the opposite thing. He couldn't handle that. He had to run from that. But he can't not have that experience he had with you. So I'm sure that bonding set in. And sometimes the gifts of folk like you who are giving things to our children don't show up until much later in your life when you grow up and you don't have to feel like it's something against your parents to have create a different set of values.
It's hard sometimes. I remember a kid when in the civil rights movement in the Eastern Shore in Cambridge, when we were doing freedom rides and sit-ins in Cambridge in the early 60s, and this white kid from the community broke the line and came with us, and he came to Baltimore, fell in love with a black woman who was part of our civil rights movement then too. And his parents came up and kidnapped him, threw him in a trunk, took him back to brainwash him into becoming a racist and a Klansman again.
Wow.
I mean, I'll never forget, that was one of the most, he was an amazing guy. And I've always wanted to find him again to find out what happened to
him.
He'd
like to find himself too, Mark.
He might have found himself again. I mean, that was a story I'll never forget. But I wish we had more time. I apologize to our listeners who can't get through. We're out of time, but I think we need to do this again. Just bring some friends on here, maybe some people in the studio, other people to talk about their experience about race, and have you join us again with your stories. And we should start collecting our stories about when we first experienced things like this and crossed the racial divide. And I think these are all kind of learning, healing, and power stories for all of us. And I hope you all can get down to the center stage, and maybe they'll have the force to open up another room to let you all in on Monday night. Michelle, great to have you back in our studio again.
Good to be here. Thank you, Mark.
Paolo Gregory Harris.
It's beautiful
to
be
here. My good friend, good to have you here, man.
Yes, indeed.
And David Schwartz, lovely to meet you.
Good to meet you too, Mark.
And I mean, your wife, I've known at least by Facebook for a while now.
Yes, you have.
See, all these other people that are in these stories are going to come up on our Facebook.
That's
good. See them again.
My fiance is across the glass. First time watching a show here at Morgan, I think. And no, it's not your first time? I was wrong. I'm always wrong about everything, but that's okay. That's just what I do. So good to have you all here. Thank you so much. And join us for Soup Stories, more conversations. And I really wish we could have gotten more callers, but we promise we'll come back and do this conversation again. I want to remind you the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. And we're going to take a break and come back, and we'll learn about how the snow in our life really has to do with global warming. And look at the closing exhibit that is at the Walters. It's going to be a great discussion. You'll be really surprised by it. Stay with us. We'll be back in just a minute.